I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. On this Veterans Day, 100 years after the armistice that ended the carnage of the First World War, Towson University history professor Nicole Dombrowski discusses the many ways the war to end all wars changed how we think about war and peace. Plus, Viva House co-founders Brendan Walsh and Willa Bickham on their faith-inspired work to eliminate war and poverty, and an update on Elizabeth McAllister's fight to end the U.S. nuclear arms program. Plus, a new United Way report finds more than a third of all Marylanders can't afford life's basic necessities. Franklin Baker, president of the United Way of Central Maryland, shares some troubling new data on the plight of Maryland's working poor. War, peace, and social justice. That's all coming up when Midday gets underway, right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Hope you had a good weekend. Thanks for being with us on this Veterans Day. How World War I shaped our understanding of the notion of warfare and what would need to happen for our world to be, in fact, without war. The bloody conflict that ended 100 years ago yesterday was originally called the Great War, and at that time it was considered the war to end all wars. Well, we know how that worked out. A little later in the program, I'll speak with Brendan Walsh and Willa Bickham. They are the founders of Viva House, a Catholic worker house, and they have devoted their lives to anti-war activism and to meeting the needs of the poor in their Southwest Baltimore neighborhood. I'll also speak with Franklin Baker. He's the president and CEO of the United Way of Central Maryland, about what we used to call the War on Poverty. The United Way has commissioned a study that shows an alarming number of people in Baltimore and throughout our state have to fight daily just to make ends meet, and how the struggles of what we know as the working poor impact the economic, social, and cultural fiber of our communities. We begin today with Dr. Nicole Dombrowski-Risser, professor of history at Towson University and the chair of the university's four-year series of commemorative lectures called Battlefields and Homefronts, World War I and Modern Life. We are streaming our conversation on the WYPR Facebook page. You're welcome to join us there. You could also drop us an email, midday@wypr.org, or you can send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. We'll take some phone calls a little later in the program. Nicole Dombrowski, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So the impact of World War I, both on the geopolitical side and then even its impact on other movements, the movements for women's equality and the peace movement in general, it can't be understated. But talk briefly, give us the thumbnail sketch for folks who don't remember their history classes about the geopolitical impact of World War I and perhaps even its relevance and its situation as a precursor of World War II.
Sure. So just to remember, the great empires fell, right? So as a consequence of losing the Central Powers, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was most notably broken up into small states, Czechoslovakia. Part of Galicia went to the making of Poland, which was carved out of the Russian Empire and out of the out of the Prussian Empire. Yugoslavia emerged as a new state. The Ottoman Empire fell, and we get Turkish nationalism, which is with us in the news recently. Certainly, the breakup of the overseas empires began to crack after World War I, and parts of the Germany lost part of their empire. So what we think of as modern day Namibia, parts of China, all of these created new nationalisms. Unfortunately, Woodrow Wilson's great idea was to give each of those small nationalities their own country. But that meant giving them their own military. And it meant to committing to their security from the point of view of France, Great Britain, a newly formed Germany, Russia more problematic because, of course, the breakup of the Russian Empire was caused by the Bolshevik Revolution, which temporarily—
Which happened concurrently with the First World War.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Gave us the Baltic states temporarily, Finland temporarily. So completely stoked, you know, the hopes and aspirations for peace, but also a militant new nationalism in Central Europe that I think is sometimes neglected.
And of course, these new democracies or new countries that were formed at this very tender time in human history were fragile.
Yeah.
I mean, they were sort of ripe for the picking in a certain way.
Yeah, many didn't know if they wanted to be democracies. Were they going to be monarchies? What were they going to do to the minorities within their borders? And we don't know that a huge refugee crisis, or we remember poorly the huge refugee crisis that lasted from 1918 all the way into the mid-1920s, which created millions of displaced people coming not only out of the broken Russian Empire, but out of places like Poland and Eastern Europe. And many of those minorities, Jewish minorities included, were displaced, flooded into places like France and Britain and New York City, and created tensions in the interwar period.
40 million casualties, 20 million deaths, about half of those civilian, half of those military personnel. We have a notion of the First World War as being a military debacle, a bunch of generals who really didn't know what the heck they were doing. Did we learn anything? Did military historians learn something about how to conduct war, or the, at the very least, the horrible ramifications of conducting war? I mean, where did the world sit at a point where people were referring to this as the war to end all wars?
So I'll take the military question later. I think the biggest takeaway was a political and a legal takeaway. So we learned that peace required active institutions and structures. And the takeaway was, and again, you know, Wilson has a lot of faults, and many people have written, you know, long critical books of him, but he understood that there needed to be a permanent architecture for peace. And that, of course, emerged with the League of Nations. And so the League of Nations emerges, and of course the United States doesn't join. That's another story we could talk about later. But it does provide a structure for permanently negotiating disputes. And the war began because of the inability to negotiate settlements to disputes, particularly about naval arms races, the buildup of weapons on land as well. So the League of Nations, in all of its manifest forms, really begins to take on that work in the 1920s. And so that was a really important takeaway. And the other important political takeaway that the Europeans knew and the Americans rejected was that the United States had to be a broker in that peace. They had to be involved. And so it's really interesting that as the United States takes up the vote to join the League of Nations, which it votes down, you know, the victor of the war in France, Clemenceau, George Clemenceau, who spoke English, had gone to Harvard, married an American woman, pens six articles that are published in non-Hearst papers across the United States, 29 papers in the United States, begging the United States to pass the inclusion and to join the League of Nations, knowing that it's dead if we don't join.
Is the nationalism espoused by our current president redolent of the nationalism that was prevalent in the 1920s and at the end of the First World War? I mean, are there parallels between what people even meant by the word nationalist and then and now?
There are parallels and important distinctions, I think. You know, what we hear from Donald Trump is a kind of, you know, America First, which was a movement during that period. Take care of what's important in terms of our own priorities, our own strategic priorities, independently of, you know, and maybe subordinating the interests of our partners. But there's a difference. In the interwar period, people like Hoover and Coolidge were isolationists, but the Republican Party in the interwar period was committed to the peace. And so even though we did not join the League of Nations, we were the forerunners in terms of creating legal institutions, deploying international lawyers to Europe throughout the interwar period. Bankers like Charles Dawes and Young from the Middle West, who were there to both finance the peace, renegotiate German debt, and then to really, David Hunter Miller out of Yale was one of the seminal lawyers in the interwar period in 1924, who was constantly going over to Europe, figuring out, okay, how can we make the treaty work? This was too ambiguous. And American lawyers during the interwar period and during the post-war period were seminally engaged in creating a partnership with Europeans. Even though we didn't want to join the League of Nations, the Republican Party believed in an active peace program during those years. That is not evident right now with John Bolton, who really doesn't even respect
the National Security Advisor.
Doesn't really respect our European partners. At least that's the articulation Emmanuel Macron made in his speech yesterday, right? Which was very.
And which he said that the polar opposite of nationalism was patriotism.
Right.
That, you know, and Mr. Trump tries to make the opposite argument to that, saying that, you know, if you're a nationalist, you are a patriot, and Macron saying no. That's the absolute antithesis to patriotism is nationalism. There's one historical interpretation that says there's a direct lineage between what the Germans were obliged to do in their surrender in World War I that led to World War II. Do you ascribe to that notion as well?
I think it's more nuanced than that, but it's important to understand that the terms of the Versailles Peace Treaty were, I think, you know, some people agree and some legal scholars disagree, that it was terrible for the Germans. It was both a humiliation. And what it did by severing Germany, by eliminating the German army, by taking away German colonies, by reducing German men in arms to 100,000, by breaking up and taking parts of Eastern Germany and creating Poland, by removing Germany as a diplomatic, voice at the table in the interwar period until later. What it did is it created the antagonisms for the Nazi Party, which is formed in 1921. And it's very important to understand that Hitler and Ludendorff understood that the Versailles Peace Treaty was a talking point for them. It was something that they could mobilize people around because in addition to the peace treaty, and this is the piece I think historians as well as, you know, some political observers miss, and this ties into, you know, what you're going to be talking about later on in the program, is that while the Germans were not signing the treaty at the end of 1919, there was a period of negotiations, and the Allied powers continued the blockade of food into Germany, and Germans were starving. German cities were rising up. Germany was in a period of civil war. The Communist Party had declared Soviets in many of the major German cities. And the Allies were blamed for starving people. So not only did they lose, you know, the war, and of course Allied armies had broken through the Siegfried Line, but they never occupied German territory. So that was a story that the Nazi Party could tell. They never occupied us. They didn't really defeat us on the ground. And now they're starving us to death. Let's vote down this peace treaty. So the peace treaty was a political mobilizing idea.
Good. And as we finish up, as a segue to our next segment, where we're going to talk to two anti-war peace activists, the peace movement, as we know it, really had its origins in the First World War. Was it because of the brutality of the carnage? Was it a political observation? I mean, how are they linked?
So, absolutely. There were a lot of linkages. Many peace activists went to jail during the war. And, for example, Bertrand Russell, who wrote about war as being unethical in 1915, he was jailed for 2 years during the war in London. Other peace activists were killed. Jean Jaurès, who was the leader of the French labor movement and who argued on July 28th, 1914, that the labor movement couldn't go into the war, that they would be killing German workers, and that was more important you know, that there was more unity than division. He was assassinated.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was assassinated. Of course, the suffragists. So I brought for you today a little story about Ellen Mott.
Just real quick. We got to finish up real quick.
Uh-huh. She wrote The Backwash of War. She was from Baltimore, and she went over and served in the nurses' corps. And her book, The Backwash of War, which testified to the human destruction of the body, it was the first to be censored. And it was the first to be published and the first to be censored. And she was a great suffragist.
Fascinating. Dr. Nicole Dombrowski is a professor of history at Towson University. She's written and lectured widely on the impact of war on society. And over the past few years, she has chaired Towson's commemorative lectures called Battlefields and Homefronts, World War I and Modern Life. Nicole, thank you so much for coming by. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
By the way, McDaniel College in Stevenson has announced a scholarship program for military veterans and active duty military personnel, as well as their children. They're eligible to receive scholarships of up to $25,000 a year. And the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs now has a program that will pay full tuition for veterans, active duty military, reservists, spouses, and their children to a thing called Teach Now. That's an online teacher certification program, which may be a good bet for veterans who want to become teachers. So we'll have a link to more information about those programs on our website, wypr.org/midday. Quick break. When we come back, I'll be joined by two veteran anti-war activists. They've been helping some of Baltimore's most needy people for more than 50 years, and they have been part of a faith-driven peace movement that began in the 1930s. Willa Bickham and Brendan Walsh, the co-founders of Viva House, join me. When we come back, we invite you to be part of our conversation with Willa Bickham and Brendan Walsh. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Over there, send the word over there, that the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, the drums rum coming everywhere. So prepare, say a prayer.